This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. How black are you in the office? What I mean is, when you go to work, do you change how you talk to people and present yourself? Even if you do you think it really makes a difference? Take the issue of identity, then make that fractal. An Asian American man might face one set of assumptions when he walks in the door at his job. A straight white man and a gay white man might face different assumptions depending on where they work. When we go to work or school, we leave a little bit of ourselves at the door. What are the best ways to navigate your identities in the workplace? Well, in a moment, we'll get a personal story from Clovie Jean Good. She's a member of Southern California's Local 94 in the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. But first, we'll talk to R. LaRue Lewis. He's an assistant professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So we've all heard, some of us have had to live with, the stereotypes of, say, the angry black woman or the geeky, desexualized Asian man. Seen and unseen identities can impact perceptions in the workplace every day. So how do our identities, whether it's, you know, how we look, how we talk, all that, impact how we work?
Well, I think the first thing is to acknowledge that identity is multifaceted. We all have race identity, class identity, gender identities, and sexual orientations. And while we may have a core belief about who we are that doesn't change, the way we present ourselves does. When we walk into a workplace, what are the things we say? How do we speak? Even what do we eat? Those type of things are what's important about the presentation of identity. Some of the work that I've done with a colleague, Dr. Kanika Bell at Clark Atlanta, has said that the social context and the situation of encounter matter most for your presentation. So when you walk into a work setting as an African-American male, are you more conscious of the way you dress and the way that you speak? Even though at the core I am who I am, in order to be successful at jobs, we often have to change behaviors and practices to get along.
I'll give you a personal example. You know, I'm sitting here right now wearing an outfit I got in South Africa, and I'm on radio, so you wouldn't know that unless I mentioned it. When I worked in broadcast television for ABC News, I had a very limited wardrobe choice. That was just what everybody wore, kind of like the power suit. And so when you have someone who, you know, you can be the same person and dress differently, but are you really perceived differently even if you change some of the outside signifiers?
I think you definitely are. Every workplace has a culture of its own. And wearing a dashiki in to work on radio is different than wearing mud cloth in on a corporate environment. People will read you as different. People will read you as nonconformist. And nonconformity in the workplace can be read as a negative characteristic. While it may not relate to your work productivity, people will perceive you as different and think that you're not trying to be a team player, which is really the key when we're talking about advancement and the ways in which things like race and gender identity mix with the work world.
Give me an example of how people can deal, whether it's from your perspective as a worker or from your perspective as a manager, with some of the assumptions that come up in the workplace and if there's tensions around them, whether it's tensions around gender, tensions around race, tensions around sexual orientation. If you're in a situation where you can see people are kind of going off the rails and doing things that are destructive or mean-spirited, how can you kind of get in the middle of it or intervene or ask for help?
Well, I'll come at it from the worker's perspective because that's the experience that I have the most with. First, recognize the stakes. If there's already a conflict brewing, where are you in the ladder, in the hierarchy? Are you able to suggest, you know what, maybe we should calm this conversation down and go into a different place? Or will your entering into the conversation or making a comment really threaten your likelihood of survival at the place? Second, I would say you need to find allies. Find other people at your job who may not have traditional identities that match with the work environment. If you're the first woman, look for other folks who may be the first openly gay person who are on the job. So finding ways in which they negotiate those situations. Third, be very alert but not preemptive. Recognize being the first or the only person on a work environment may mean that you have issues around your identity, but that doesn't mean every time your identity is brought up that it's an issue or a cause for concern. And lastly, you have to be open to extending conversations, recognizing that people will come to you as someone who may look different or seem different and want to talk with you, but also you have to suggest to extend this to an institutional conversation. How can the work environment be shifted? How could we even bring in consultants to make sure that everyone's identities and everyone's backgrounds are equally valued in creating a collaborative work environment?
Well, Professor Lewis, when you think about solutions, you've mentioned some very good ones for individuals, but what about the whole idea of diversity training? It's something that some people go to a company and they're kind of compelled to go through some kind of training. Other people, it'll never come up. But what do you think of the whole idea of what diversity training is and whether or not it's effective?
Well, I think diversity training in its original context, out of this multiculturalism movement in which everyone comes in and explores their differences and agrees to be happy to be different, doesn't actually help us move that far along in the workplace. Instead, I like the models of people like Carmen Van Krokov with New Demographic or Rachel Andre with Engaged Diversity, where people start with discussing who they are and how those identities matter for privilege and power. If we're talking about differences at work, we have to really recognize that some people have more of an ability to be who they are openly and other people have less. And how can we reshape the conversation not to just concentrate on difference, but differences in power, privilege, and the potential to create a collaborative space?
How would you rate your own experience? Meaning, you're a professor, and academia can be very politicized, but it's also a place where, you know, these discussions are not considered totally out of the blue. How would you rate the kind of conversations that go on in the context in which you operate?
I think for many people, it'd be hard to believe that academia struggles with the same issues. It's a workplace environment. Just because people may be professionals doesn't mean that they're necessarily used to dealing with these issues. So one of the first things I have to recognize as a young African-American male is that I'm often elected to be a role model or serve on committees of diversity requirements. What is important for me is to make sure to hold back and not jump at every opportunity that's provided, because in spaces that have historically not included people who are African-American, institution can be very excited to have you present and want you to do work. But those additional burdens of work can also prohibit me from doing my primary job of researching and educating students.
So it sounds like there's the idea of the black man's burden as it translates to the workplace. Like, A lot of black folks who I know, and not just black folks, but people who have identities that are not the most common at their workplace say, well, why should I do all the work of educating people?
Right. And it's very important that we as individuals recognize that there are entire firms and groups who work on making sure that these issues can actually be discussed in productive manners. So my job is to educate people on race, but it's not my job to coach my colleagues on being anti-racist, anti-sexist, or overly heteronormative or working against heteronormativity. You have to create the space to make your contribution, but also know when to step back, because taking that burden too far will mean that you probably won't be successful at your own job as you attempt to educate your colleagues.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was R. LaRue Lewis, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York, and he joined us from NPR's studios in New York. And now we're going to take the discussion to the life of the docks. The busiest ports in the country are right here in the backyard of our studio. The ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles see roughly 16 million containers every year, carrying everything from toilet paper to pickup trucks. Somebody has to unload and coordinate all that cargo, and it's not always a man. I've got Clovey Jean Good sitting with me here in the studio. She's a member of Southern California's Local 94 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Great to have you with us.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and it's great to see you. So take me back to 1984 when you first became what's called a longshoreman casual. What does that mean?
A longshore casual, that's part-time work in the industry. When they have an overflow of work, they have to hire part-time workers.
But what does a longshoreman – well, first of all, do you call yourself a longshoreman, woman, person? How do
I call myself a longshoreman. That's the name, and that's the name that I go by. But you have a lot of women that would prefer to be called longshorewoman.
Okay. So what do you do?
We import, export, stevedoring. We load, unload vessels. We receive cargo that has to be shipped out to different countries. And we load and unload ships, organize the whole operation. When I first started, I was a part-time worker, and we just worked longshore. Longshore workers basically handle the labor part. Then as time went on, I became a marine clerk, which we organize everything that has to be done for us loading and unloading the vessels. And now in my latter years, to my 24th year, I'm a longshore foreman, where actually I am a walking boss over longshoremen. I'm their boss.
Your dad set an example for you. What road did he have to walk to do what he did?
My father was a young man who became a longshoreman in the early 60s. And as we all know, back in the early 60s, African Americans was not given the opportunities as other different nationalities. So he was one of the first men that had to take on that struggle and had to fight for his rights to be able to be a skilled longshoreman, to be able to do all different aspects of the job and to open the doors so that when I decided to walk into the doors, that I would have an opportunity.
There were moments when he had a hard time, right, dealing with his coworkers?
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of hard times. You know, they wasn't accustomed to African-American men driving winches. It was only given to a certain category of men. So he had to take on those struggles to teach himself. No one was teaching him, training him, and he had to take on the responsibility of demanding the job, going out and working the job when everyone would leave off the vessels and didn't even want to work with an African-American man. Like, they didn't want to, you walked in a restaurant, they didn't want to eat in the same restaurant with you. They also did not want to work on the same vessels.
What did he say when his baby girl wanted to go and take this kind of a job?
Oh, he did not want that. He did not want his daughter on the waterfront. He felt that he had struggled long and far enough and that he didn't want me in that type of environment.
Why did you want to do it?
Because I was, you know, like I said, apple don't fall too far from the tree. I knew that it was a great career. I knew that it was excellent money, and I knew that I could become a great independent woman, help myself and help others. So I decided to that I had to do it.
What were give me an example of one of the worst moments that you've had to deal with and one of the best moments that you've had to deal with in your career?
Well, I would say one of the worst moments is, you know, as an African-American woman, the different cultures did not want to, I'm an aggressor. I want the best. I want to be the boss. I want to run the operation. And I had to take on that challenge. And so I had a lot of bad days because of people where everybody was fighting against a woman or African-American woman climbing the ladder. There was a glass ceiling there. So I had plenty of challenging days where I had to fight for my rights.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by fight for your rights?
Well, you know, I took on my employer. You know, I went ahead and I sued them, and I did what I had to do to break the glass ceiling so that women, African-American women, and everyone can have an equal employment opportunity.
What are or were some of the good moments? I mean, it sounds like you've moved up in the game.
Oh, the good moments is that, you know, I love the people. You know, I love going to work. I love the challenge. I love being the one who is running this big $1 trillion operation. So every day that I go to work, you know, is a good day. You know, you can talk about the bad and things that have happened, but at the end of the day, it's all been a good day because you can teach people, you can train people, you can advise people on how to grow, how to, you know, learn how to drive a crane or go learn how to be a marine clerk. So those are the good days because you can teach. I mean, I have the power to be able to teach and instruct with no problem.
Have you ever felt that you had to try to leave yourself at the door as a black woman?
No, I'm not leaving myself at the door. When I walk in as Clovie Jean Good. I know that I'm a beautiful person. I know that I hold God within my heart. So when I walk in the door, I walk in being who I am.
Who do you mentor?
My father.
You mentor your father?
No, I don't mentor him. You know what? I have a group of girls, 15 girls at the Los Angeles Will Rogers Willowbrook Boys and Girls Club. You're only supposed to have one girl, but, you know, I'm fortunate to have 15.
So I have That's a lot.
Yeah, so I mentor 15 girls. That's a secret, though. Don't nobody know I really do that, but I mentor.
They will now.
Yeah, I mentor every young lady that comes across my path. You know, that's what I do. I buy books and talk to children and talk to girls and teach them how to be better individuals.
Do you ever, do any of them express an interest in being a longshoreman?
You know, a lot of people, everybody I know expressed the interest in being a longshoreman. I get phone calls every single day. But, you know, I always just tell them to get their education. You know, you don't know what you're going to do as you grow. So as long as you apply yourself and get good education and have some type of path that you're working for, some goal that you're working for, you have no idea what boat's going to ride by that you get to jump on.
One of the favorite things that I see when I look at you is that you have this very extravagant pen with a big silk yellow rose on it. And it's a very feminine part of who you are, and you're working in this very masculine field. Why are you carrying that pen?
You know, this is my good luck pen. My auntie, she made me about 12 of them. And everywhere I go, because I'm a writer, I usually write notes, take notes, and so I can always know what I'm talking about and being prepared. So I always carry this pen with me. You know, it's my writing tool. But I am very soft, so it's, you know, it's part of me.
All right. Well, Clovie Jean, it's great to hear from you, and it sounds like you and your dad are quite a team.
Yeah, we're quite a team.
We were speaking with Clovie Jean Good. She's a walking boss in Southern California's Local 94 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and she was right here with me with her beautiful flowered yellow rose pen in our NPR West studios in Culver City.